History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. We've learned they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to do something about it. We just need to take a little initiative and ask a few questions, invest a little time in listening, and we never know just how much those long-buried memories might take on new meaning in the here and now. Our goal has always been to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only do we find ourselves educated, not only are we always entertained, but so often, we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation, and we are coming up on a very significant anniversary that we're going to devote this episode to, as well as next week's program, the 80th anniversary of the massive invasion of Normandy on June 6, 1944. I've been in Washington, D.C. for the past week, and if you ever have the privilege of visiting the National World War II Memorial in our nation's capital, the latest addition to that hallowed ground is a must-see. On display, the full text of President Franklin D. Roosevelt's address to the nation that day, heard over many of the same radio airwaves broadcasting this program right now, and really not addressed to the people as much as it was to the Almighty, and thus those words being more commonly referred to as FDR's D-Day prayer.
My fellow Americans, last night when I spoke with you about the fall of Rome, I knew at that moment that troops of the United States and our allies were crossing the channel in another and greater operation. It has come to pass with success thus far. And so, in this poignant hour, I ask you to join with me in prayer. Almighty God, our sons, pride of our nation, this day have set upon a mighty endeavor, a struggle to preserve our republic, our religion, and our civilization, and to set free a suffering humanity. Lead them straight and true. Give strength to their arms, stoutness to their hearts, steadfastness in their faith. They will need thy blessings. Their road will be long and hard. For the enemy is strong. He may hurl back our forces. Success may not come with rushing speed, but we shall return again and again. And we know that by thy grace and by the righteousness of our cause, our sons will triumph. They will be sore tried by night and by day without rest until the victory is won. The darkness will be rent by noise and flame. Men's souls will be shaken with the violences of war. For these men are lately drawn from the ways of peace. They fight not for the lust of conquest. They fight to end conquest. They fight to liberate. They fight to let justice arise and tolerance and goodwill among all thy people. They yearn but for the end of battle, for their return to the haven of home. Some will never return. Embrace these, Father, and receive them, thy heroic servants, into thy kingdom. And for us at home, fathers, mothers, children, wives, sisters, and brothers of brave men overseas, whose thoughts and prayers are ever with them, help us, Almighty God, to rededicate ourselves in renewed faith in Thee in this hour of great sacrifice. Many people have urged that I call the nation into a single day of special prayer. But because the road is long and the desire is great, I ask that our people devote themselves in a continuance of prayer. As we rise to each new day, and again when each day is spent, let words of prayer be on our lips, invoking Thy help to our efforts. Give us strength, too, strengthen our daily tasks, to redouble the contributions we make in the physical and the material support of our armed forces. And let our hearts be stout, to wait out the long travail, to bear sorrows that may come, to impart our courage unto our sons, wheresoever they may be. And, O Lord, give us faith. Give us faith in Thee, faith in our sons, faith in each other, faith in our united crusade. Let not the keenness of our spirit ever be dulled. Let not the impacts of temporary events, of temporal matters of but fleeting moment, let not these deter us in our unconquerable purpose. With Thy blessing, we shall prevail over the unholy forces of our enemy. Help us to conquer the apostles of greed and racial arrogances. Lead us to the saving of our country, and with our sister nations into a world unity that will spell a sure peace, a peace invulnerable to the schemings of unworthy men, and a peace that will let all men live in freedom, reaping the just rewards of their honest toil. Thy will be done, Almighty God. Amen.
President Franklin D. Roosevelt on June 6, 1944, and among the nearly 1.5 million Allied troops who would eventually be involved in Operation Overlord, a young infantryman from Oklahoma named E.T. Roberts, who came ashore on Omaha Beach with the 29th Infantry Division.
We were to hit Omaha 820 D-Day with assisted assault, we were told. And they said there'd be bomb craters on the beach when we trained. And I trained with rifle and flamethrower, too. I had a flamethrower when I hit the beach. And I went off the ramp, and I never did touch bottom. And I turned the flamethrower loose. And I had a soldier behind me that had my full field pack. I had a lot of good stuff in my pack, in my bed, in my eats, and everything in that pack, and he had my rifle. He's supposed to go off the same time as me behind me, and as soon as I got rid of that flamethrower, give me my rifle and stuff and let me go, but I've never seen that boy yet today. I don't know whatever happened to all that crew, but I had to turn that flamethrower loose. It's going to drown me. And the tide was so high, it come up under my helmet like it broke my neck, and I had to lay there on the beach until I got my neck straightened up and I crawled over and got a rifle from a soldier that was wounded there, or dead. I'm sure he's dead because I see his entrails and stuff laying out on the ground that were strapped on what I disintegrated him almost. Anyway, I got up on the beach and went up on the hill, and all I ever saw of my whole company was seven of us left. I don't know whatever happened to the rest. I've never seen them yet today. And then when we went into combat, I got wounded about 29 days after I got into combat at St. Lo. And I went out, and when I came back into combat, they didn't send me back to my company. They sent me back to 116th.
As you're heading toward Omaha Beach and you're on that landing craft, I imagine the big picture of everything you could see in every direction was something that you've never seen again since. What did it look like as you were approaching that beach?
When I was sitting out there, we were hit June 5th. We were supposed to hit the 5th, and the tide was so high that we couldn't go in. We had to sit out there, and you could step from ship to ship. That was taking soldiers in there, and you couldn't see nothing across that ocean as far as you could see with ships and stuff going in to make the invasion in there. And we went in the next June 6th, the next day. All of us was seasick, but when you say ramp down, you got to get off. You can't turn back. You got to go. So we had to go. And when you hear people today say, I'm sick, I can't go to work, think about something like that and see how that fix when they dump you off over there seasick. And the boat was full of vomit and stuff that way. It really was. It was a mess. So that's what we went through with. And then it was 9 days before we ever got any good clothes to put on. We hit that salt water and stuff, you can imagine what our feet and stuff was.
And I want to ask you, as you hit that water, you described for us having that flamethrower on, and this is a big, heavy thing that you're going to wear on your back, 72 pounds of equipment there, and you come off that ramp, you're expecting your feet are going to hit bottom, but you just kept sinking?
Well, they told us and said, unbuckle your chin straps because the tide will come up under your helmet. And I didn't unbuckle my chin strap. The flamethrower, I thought would help me too, but the flamethrower is what took me down so fast that tide came up under and hurt my neck, broke my neck, I guess. And since I came home in civilian life, I'd had two discs replaced in my neck and everything.
It's not exaggerating to say that you nearly died just coming off the landing craft.
Oh, sure, I'm lucky to be here today. People could never, I can't even understand myself how I ever lived through the smoke and gunfire. He said, you couldn't hear nothing. It was the smoke, it was strangling, it was so thick, gun smoke. Just shell after shell and a big facing a cannon sitting inside of a wall that was firing out there and nothing. I saw little LCVPs come in there, not one soldier get off of it. That shell, the way they had it, the gun emplacement, they said had 4 foot of cement in it and sitting in the walls, just like going into a side of a house and look out the windows. The gun placements looked like that to me. I could see them firing all out of there. I told the guy on the Marine or sailor, whatever he was on the ship, I said, open fire on him. Open fire on that guy there. He was so scared, he run off the top. I don't know where he ever went to. That's when we was going in, I could see that firing was taking place there. But when I got out on the beach and I got straightened up and got up off of the beach, I met about 7 people from the same company I didn't know, even hardly. Got me a rifle and stuff and went on through there, and then I got wounded with St. Louis. I got changed from first scout to a squad leader, and we were completely replaced 9 times. So when they start to ask me, tell me names and stuff, I finally got to where I said, I'm just going to call you soldier. And that's about the way I think today. People tell me names, and I can't think of names. I think of stuff like that. So many names came and said, well, this is so-and-so, this so-and-so, and maybe 30 minutes he'd be not there. I've seen him last about 30 minutes in combat, and that's about it.
Certainly there on June 6th, and it's been called the longest day for a really good reason, especially the part of it you were in.
I couldn't get off of there. I was sick and had to lay there, and I got my neck straightened up, and the water was solid blood. I mean, it was just like a bloodbath. Going through it there. The beach You couldn't walk without stepping on a dead soldier. You crawled and made your way around through there to get off of the beach, and finally I did. Got off the beach. I don't know. Some people say, how long did it take you to get off the beach? I don't know. And I don't think anybody else would. There's so much going on and everything that you don't, you couldn't even tell anybody your name, probably.
So it's definitely loud. I'm sure the smell was horrific. Obviously, what you're seeing is something that no one has ever seen or experienced before. And I'm just trying to imagine myself in your shoes. How did you keep going? Weren't you scared to death?
You're past scared. You don't even know who you're at or what you're doing. Think about fighting day and night. 27 days without ever coming off of the front line, and the only way it got you off is to get shot. And then I was out 26 days back into combat. Went back to England and patched me up and sent me back into combat.
Another thing you mentioned about D-Day, you talked about finding seven other guys from your company. For people who aren't familiar with how that works, how many people were in your company to begin with? How many from your company were supposed to hit that beach?
200-something soldiers there in the company. I never did see any of the boys, the lieutenant or nobody. I'd never seen no one after that. So I don't know where the bunch of them went. One good friend that I did meet him, and he went in with me there. And last time I saw him, he had his heel shot off. We hit the ground, machine gun fire came up. He didn't put down his feet flat like you're supposed to turn your feet out flat. He stuck his heels up, he put his toes to the ground, and he shot his heels off. And I went over and talked to him a little bit, and I said, well, I got to go. We was moving at that time, and I had to go on, and we was trying to run them people out of there. And that's, I don't know whatever happened to that boy. It's just one of them things that happens in combat. I had another friend came in there that I knew, got acquainted with from Oklahoma boy, Donald Crawford. The artillery shell was coming over, and I told him, I said, get your whole artillery. You can hear artillery coming over. And I said, go get your hole. And I don't know why he did, but he put a piece of tin over his hole. When he started to go down the hole, piece of tin caught him on right above his forehead, just scalped him almost. I don't know whatever happened to that boy either. Things like that happens in combat.
It's time for our first break, but we're going to hear more Omaha Beach memories when we come back. Men who were there for the longest day, June 6th, 1944, as we approach the 80th anniversary of that courageous quest. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties, and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 1,800 veterans will have seen their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes. Celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special D-Day edition of the program in advance of the 80th anniversary of the invasion of Normandy. Here's another first-hand account of what it was really like on Omaha Beach on June 6, 1944, from 1st Infantry Division survivor David McCoy.
Well, the idea we had in combat was that we weren't going to make it home. That's the way we felt, the way we was involved in the battle and everything else, we just figured do the best we can because we didn't think we'd make it home. We were notified to prepare to go on a certain day, and of course then they called it off because the weather was too bad. And it's a good thing we didn't go that particular day because the Germans was thinking we were coming that particular day, and we didn't. So we went the next day, but the next day it was kind of rough because a lot of the guys got sick on the ship. I was on what they call a LST, where you load a lot of equipment and stuff, only a few troops on it. You get over there and they drop a ramp and you go off into the water and get onto the beach. So it was a rough, rough deal going over that day we did, but the Germans had already moved out some of their troops because we didn't come the day we were supposed to, so it kind of helped us a bit.
Yeah, and there was another twist of fate that would help you out in your situation, but you mentioned driving a truck off the LST. What kind of truck was that? What was it carrying? How big was it?
It's an armored half-track ammunition carrier. I was loaded with ammunition, so I had to get off and get onto the beach, and I had to wait on the beach to make sure I got my four guns off, my four artillery pieces, if they got stranded in the water, because the water was still pretty deep, because when I got off, it come all the way up into my floorboard. And I had to wait on the sand to make sure I got my four guns off. If you understand what 4th of July is, it was 4th of July and then some.
And I want to touch on that. Let's come back to it. But before that, you were initially supposed to be one of the first ships getting there. You're supposed to be part of the first wave of American forces hitting the beach at Omaha Beach on D-Day?
That's correct. We were supposed to get in there, but we couldn't get in because the Navy would drop the anchor, and when he went to the end, he'd tell us to get off. Well, the first time he dropped it, we put it one big truckload of ammunition off, and it went completely under. So they pulled out again, came back in the second time. We let some guys test the water, and they went under. So we pulled out, and our commander told the Navy commander, you either get us in this time or we're going to throw you overboard. I mean, we had to get in. So the third time was when my eye came off. Then I got off, like I say, and then I had to wait to get my four artillery pieces off.
So this is about, what, about noontime or early afternoon on D-Day?
No, it was just before noon.
Just before noon. And the people who did get in there at 6 o'clock in the morning got a very rude welcome, and it sounds like it wasn't very pleasant for you. You said 4th of July, and I think that tells us a little bit. Can you give us a sense of what you saw and what you heard as you drove that truck off that LST?
Well, even before I drove it off, we heard all the shells. The Germans did a lot of airburst. It was terrible before we got off, and hated to get off and go into all of that. But
and for people at home that weren't there and don't get what you're saying when you say an airburst, explain to us what that is and why that's so deadly and dangerous.
Well, it's a big shell that they fire at you, and it blows up in the air so that all the shrapnel will hit whoever's below, you know. Before I got off, I had binoculars, and I was looking over at one of the troop ships that was sitting there. It had got in there, and the tide went out, and it was sitting up in the sand, and the troops were getting off, and I saw these troops going down the ramp, and they was falling off in the water about halfway down the ramp. And I kept looking, and I saw something, and then I spotted a machine gun up on the hill that was shooting the troops as he's coming down the ramp. I told my commander, and he called the destroyer escort that was right around us, and they spotted the machine gun, and they fired three shells. One shell went above it, one went below it, and one blew it up. We could see it blow up, and it set up there shooting our troops as they was coming off the ship.
Well, and I know you're not looking for the glory or a pat on the back here, but it sounds like you probably saved a lot of lives by spotting that and pointing it out to them. And that's hard to talk about, I know, when you think about that. Maybe your own life was one of the ones saved in that process.
When I got my half-track off onto the sand and was just waiting, I was under heavy fire at the time. While I was sitting there waiting, one of the troops was laying over there rolling, and I got out and went over and asked, are you hit? Are you hurt? And I noticed it was a one-star general, and he was on our ship when I didn't know he was on there. And I said, are you hurt? No, I got to get this life belt off. We got to leave it on the beach. And I said, USB, get the hell out of here. So I kicked him and told him go. And he run over to that ship. And just as I got my guns off, that ship blew up. So I don't know whether that general got killed or not. I never seen him after that. but we were getting heavy fire as I was coming off, real heavy. And some of the troops that we had on ship with us, they would get on the barrels of the gun as it's coming off and ride, and some of the air bursts knocked them off, and some of them got run over, and some of them got killed as it was coming off.
And I'm just trying to imagine, and I see the emotion in your eyes all these years later. I'm trying to imagine how you keep going in a situation like that. How do you, I mean, you said that you didn't expect to make it through, but that kind of cements it for you, doesn't it?
Yeah, it sure did. I was concerned because the half track was solid armor, but if I would have got an airburst right over it with all the ammunition I was carrying, it was a death trap.
Yeah, you would have blown here to smithereens. So you were unable to get on the beach and unload all your guns?
Yes. Yes, we got all the guns off of the beach. We got them up into position, and we pulled up the valley and got up on a hill and got settled down for the evening. I pulled a half track up on a hill and found a spot, and I dug like a grave, and then I drove my front wheels of my half track right over the grave, and then I slid under the grave, and I slept in there overnight, and I was still getting bullets fired at me, but they couldn't hit me because I was down in there. There was a German across a hedgerow. During the night, he'd fire, and the bullets would hit the hedgerow, and it'd go poop, poop. And at daylight, our troops come by and shot the guy just over the hedgerow. But then they go on to a little building that was there, and there was a person at that little building that was directing the traffic for the Germans on the beach, and they shot the person. After they shot the person, they turned him over, and it was a woman. A German woman directing all the fire on the beach. They had guns sitting in there about 5 miles in, shooting the big shells on the beach.
Well, and we're getting a taste of why June 6, 1944 has been called the longest day. And when you describe where you spent that night, and you talked about digging the grave and then parking your half track over it so nothing could get in that. Did someone teach you to do that, or is that just something you thought up?
Oh, that's something you do. You either dig a foxhole or you dig a grave, something you can get in. So I thought the easiest way was to dig that so I could lay in it at night. And I pulled a half-track front wheels over it because the back wheels are all like caterpillar wheels. Right. So I had a good place to stay overnight.
But I imagine you didn't get much sleep.
No, I didn't get much sleep. I got a little bit of shut-eye, but not much.
And how do you wake up the next day ready to do anything after you've endured that? I mean, when they say the longest day... Is that what it felt like to you?
Yeah, it was a long day, all right. I don't think we even was concerned about it. It was just so much action going on. And, of course, I didn't have any trouble waking up because all the fire going up all around me that next morning at daylight. So no problem.
I don't want to make you dwell on the stuff that's difficult to dwell on. But for those of us who weren't there and didn't experience it, what was the most difficult thing for you to witness that day?
I think the biggest problem was seeing so many bodies. It was a real disaster. Yeah. Most of my buddies were gone. Later on, about a week after we got in and so forth, well, maybe 2 weeks, I was still driving a half track, and on my half track, I had a machine gun, a 50 caliber and a 30 caliber. The chaplain got on with me, and we were going to see about burying some bodies. So we pulled up this one place and got out, and we dug a grave for this body, and we was getting ready to put him in it. We had his tag and his helmet we was going to put on a stick there. We got ready to roll him in, and all hell broke loose. There was a bunch of Germans dug in on the hedgerow over on the side that our troops had already passed by, and they started firing at us. And the chaplain says, "Hell with that Heinle, let's get out of here." So we left him, and we went and got in the half track, and they was firing at us. I get the 30 caliber machine gun and started firing back. 30 caliber don't do any good. So I rolled a 50 caliber around, and I fired it, and the Germans came out from the hedgerow. I think it was about 10 or 12 of them come out and surrendered. We held them there and called for backup, and they came and took them back. And then later after that, I went on up a ways further with our tanks. I think we had six tanks, and we was pulling into this field, and we was going to go in and park in the field. We get inside of there and run right into a big old Panther tank, and we had to get the hell out of there. And as we go out, our troops loaded up on the tanks, and the tanks come out, and they spun so fast in the road that one of the machine gunners in one of the tanks got thrown over, and he pulled the trigger, and he shot some of the soldiers on the tank in front of us. And I went out with a half-track and tore up a bunch of communication lines as I was getting the hell out of there. Then it wasn't long after that until the commander's driver got injured, and the commander didn't have a driver, so nobody wanted to drive him because his Jeep has to stay right on the front line. So I told him if he get somebody to drive my death trap, I would take over. So I took over driving for the commander.
So you preferred driving the Jeep, even if you were on the front lines, to driving that half track?
Oh, yes, yes. Yeah, it was tough, but I enjoyed it more than I did driving a half track.
I know that this is all, at this point, every day probably is new experiences for you and things you've never seen before. But being with the regimental commander like that, did you get a different perspective on what was going on and what the war looked like to you?
Yeah, very much so. Very much so. I was involved with every bit of it. Sometimes I would be in a place where he'd tell me, don't you move until I call you. And I didn't get along with the captain or the major, and they was always trying to get after me. Every time they turned around to get after me, and of course I would go to the old man, which my commander, and tell him what's happened. And when I'd see them get out of line, I'd tell the commander, and he'd go over and chew them out, and they knew what was going on. So we had a battle between the major and the captain. The major was a big guy with a big goatee. All he'd do is pat his foot and twist his goatee and say, Corporal McCoy, you do this, and, you know, so he sent me on a deal one time. I almost got killed, and the commander, oh, man, he got after him.
Almost got killed. That sounds like another one of your close calls, huh?
Yeah, they hit my Jeep, blew a tire, knocked a tree down across my Jeep, and I managed to get away.
How'd you pull that off with a tree down over your Jeep?
Well, with the four-wheel drive, I managed to get out from under it, but still I had a flat tire, so I finally got down under a railroad track and had to put on a spare tire.
Well, see, I thought you were going to tell us that you were such a great driver that you had the same Jeep the entire way through the rest of the war.
Yeah.
Trying to be lighthearted with stuff that's still painful. I apologize, but you had three Jeeps?
Lost three Jeeps. Yeah, got all blown up, but luckily we didn't get hurt. The last one, like I say, P-51 and 47s were told to shoot anything in the area. And we had smoke screens and flares and everything else, and they came down and hit our Jeep. But the old man and I was in a ditch, so we were okay. So we didn't get hurt.
I realize this could be a needle in the haystack here, but of all the situations like that where it came close to your number being called, what's the one that took your breath away the most, or the one you think back on now and say, man, I was really fortunate to survive that?
Well, there was so many of them. The one that really got me was we were searching a house. I started over to the window to raise the window, and one of my guys knocked me down. And I, what the hell you knocked me down for? He says, see that booby trap? So if I'd opened the window, I'd have got hit with a booby trap. Well, then as I go out the door, they had gone out, and just as I stepped out, a mortar landed right beside me at the door, but it was one of our mortars that hit the roof and slid off, and it was a dud. And they had to move me. I couldn't move. They had to come and get me.
I'd be frozen stiff, too, and I've had a few other veterans tell me stories like that where a dud landed right next to them. I imagine you're frozen there because you're still waiting for it to go off, right?
Oh, it scared me. I couldn't move. I couldn't move. It's one of those things.
When you finally realize that it is a dud, and that you dodged that bullet, literally, what goes through your mind? Are you giving thanks to somebody? Are you just taking a deep breath, a sigh of relief? What do you do?
I don't really think about it. I know it's just one of those things. If I go, I go. And, you know, you're in combat, and you never know when it's going to go. We were standing around behind the openings on a 105 Hollister, one of the artillery pieces, and a bunch of us just standing there talking, and one of the buddies said, I'm going to take a nap, and he laid over there and went to sleep. All of a sudden, in come shells. Wow, big air burst, and it didn't hit any of us, but we said, hey, he didn't even wake up. So we go over and pull the cover off of him, and he's all blown up. And that's how close it came to us. Just a lot of things like that happen. I was in so many different places to where that I'm just lucky to be here.
When we come back, a man whose job it was to bury those men who paid the ultimate price on D-Day. A special edition of Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level. When prices start going up, we all look for ways to save. So here's a simple message for you. Look no further than EECU. Did you know you can finance your mortgage through EECU? How about a home equity line of credit? EECU makes HELOC loans easy. And when the car business is all over the map, the auto loan rates are as steady as can be. EECU is a not-for-profit credit union, not a bank. So the members always win. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today or call 1-800-5
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, preparing you for the 80th anniversary of the invasion of Normandy with the remembrances of three men who were there on the bloodiest beach, Omaha Beach, on June 6, 1944. Vito Mastrangelo, the son of Italian immigrants, would end up losing his brother Bert in World War II. Vito's job in Normandy was to make sure Gold Star heroes were honored with the dignity they deserved.
We took off on June the 5th, got in the middle of the channel, had to return back. The weather was terrible, just terrible. So we spent the night there. Next morning we took off on June the 6th. I had one squad on that landing craft and a few extra men that I didn't know who they were. So we got to the edge of Normandy and we were just circling around. Finally a destroyer came after us. He says, they need that bulldozer on the beach. So that's why I landed on the beach on June the 6th, early afternoon. Spent the night soaking wet. Every inch of my body was wet. And spent the night there on the beach in an old German trench.
Let me ask you. Before you left, and you mentioned you guys took off June 5th, got halfway there, had to turn around because of the weather. But before you even left, was there anything that suggested to you or gave you any indication of what you were going to be getting into?
Not really. But as soon as you got on the beach, you knew what had happened.
And what was it that you were expecting you guys were going to do? Did you have an assignment or a duty that you were looking forward to at that point?
At the time, I hate to talk about the early time there on the beach, but it was terrible. But it was a distraction to see a body on the beach, incoming troops. Those all had to be cleared out of the way, which my little squad. I want to mention my company was 607th Graves Registration Company, 3rd Platoon. There's four platoons in the company. As a third, we landed there early afternoon.
I want to make sure I'm hearing you correctly. So as you're heading over, and you've got these men that you described, and you told us they told you you needed to go in because they needed the bulldozer.
Uh-huh.
So you know, before you even step ashore, your job is going to be taking care of guys who've been killed already.
Yes. Yes.
How did you feel about that?
I didn't think too much of it.
Yeah.
It was a job, you had to do it. But all these memories do come back. And they did come back 50 years later.
Because you went back physically.
That's right. For 50 years, my folks didn't know what I did. I never did tell them.
Wow.
They never asked, so I didn't say nothing. And I think that's mostly GIs did the same thing. I don't think they talked about the war to their folks.
It's been my experience just in interviewing hundreds of vets that most of them will say exactly what you're saying.
Yeah.
And the reasons they usually give are, one, I didn't want to be bragging about it.
Yeah.
Two, which I'm guessing applies in your case, There were so many who didn't come home.
That's right.
Including your own brother and all those guys you buried over there.
Absolutely.
But from the get-go, your first experience of war is clearing away dead bodies so more troops can come ashore?
Especially on a beach.
You just had to move them out of the way?
You had to pick them up.
And then what do you do with them?
We would have a special place. We had tents, put them in the tank. You had to keep them away from the eyes of incoming troops.
So you didn't want the guys coming in to see how many had already been killed?
No.
Wow.
No.
So this is, in one way, logistical to make sure there's space for troops to come ashore and vehicles. And maybe even more importantly, this is a psychological move that you don't want guys to be thinking, hey, that's going to happen to me.
That's right.
So from the time you hit the beach, that's what you're doing?
Yeah, my men were doing.
I'm just trying to imagine what that feels like, because you're...
And I was 20 years old.
Can 20 you imagine? Years old.
20 years old. I had 25 men with me, and that's what we did. Later on, as the battle moved on, some of those men were ordered to all emergency hospitals. They would tour those every day and pick up who didn't survive the day before. Some of the sites you can't talk about, even to this day. War is hell.
I heard you say that there are some things you still can't talk about, and I'm not trying to get you to, but of the things you are comfortable sharing, for those of us who weren't there on what's been called the longest day, on Omaha Beach, from mid-afternoon on, what was the most difficult thing that you dealt with, the most challenging situation you had to endure?
The sights. Some of the sights were terrible. The guy that shot, you know, it's terrible to see him, but there's a... situations that some of them had horrible deaths. Like I said, it's been over 70 years. It's still on my mind. Terrible situations I've seen. It bothers me to this day. Many nights. Well, last night I didn't fall asleep until midnight.
Because you're seeing images?
Oh, yeah. All the time.
And this has been going on for 70 years?
Over 70 years. You never forget. You never forget. Especially... We lost 18 men on what they call a dry run a few weeks before in the English Channel. That was shut up for over 50 years.
This is Exercise Tiger you're
Tiger,
talking about?
Right.
Yeah.
They were 758 were killed by German PT boats that night, and 18 of our men were gone.
And you were there?
Luck of the draw again. I'm 3rd Platoon. We didn't go out that night, but the 4th went out that night.
Wow.
They got shot up. Just the luck of the draw.
And a lot of people still have never heard about that, but what you're saying, even though that happened before this invasion, the government kept it quiet.
Oh, yeah, for years.
And no one heard about it for decades.
For decades, that's correct.
But it was a big tragedy because here are the Allies practicing an invasion. The Germans show up and pick off hundreds of Allied troops.
That's correct.
And that would have been you if your platoon had been called.
I knew some of those guys at the 4th Platoon. Some of those guys, their wives were pregnant at the time. They would tell me. And those children never seen their dad.
And here you are, 20 years old, processing that.
Yeah.
And then you hit the beach at Normandy. And when you say things that you see over and over again, I don't want to make you share any details you're not comfortable with, but what you're talking about are the way some of these guys were killed, the conditions their bodies were in, and then I imagine just the magnitude of it, how many there were. Am I on the right track?
You're on the right track, right on. Yep.
Did you sleep that night?
No. You know, that first night on the beach, they said, okay, there's a German trench over there. Jump in that trench. You stay there all night long. It was an L-shaped trench. The leg of that L-shape followed the beach, and I was on the turn of the L. During the night, we got strafed. People that were lying in the beach. The next morning, I reached around the corner. I says, hey, how are you doing? I didn't hear a whisper from him. And when the sun came up, he was gone. Just arm's length from me. There again, the luck of the draw.
So German planes had come over at night and just strafed the beach.
Yeah.
And you heard it and saw it, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah.
And you knew it was coming close to you.
You hunker down and sure.
But it wasn't until the morning that you realized how close.
Yeah, that's right. Within 3 feet from me.
Wow.
Yeah.
Welcome to the war, Vito.
Yep.
Holy smokes. And if that wasn't enough, tell us about what you had to do on June 7th.
June 7th. Well, we started a little temper cemetery right on the beach. And here comes a big old general. He says, we're not going to have a mass grave here because he's seen the bulldozer. It was a lot of sagebrush. we had to have that cleared off.
Right.
We had the troops dig in 6 feet down. He was digging mostly sand there. But those bodies were moved later on in a week, at the end of the week, moved up the temporary cemetery that everybody saw on Private Ryan up on the bluff.
Right. But for that day, you probably spent that whole day overseeing the burial of hundreds of Americans right on the beach.
Right on the beach,
458. Dead Americans.
I got a picture of that. Somebody shot that picture a few days later, and somebody sent me that picture. It's in my files here.
Uh-huh. Were you just numb to it all, or did you feel the weight of that?
You have to. It'll drive you crazy. What for? We would have wives come and visit the cemetery. They were in uniform. They'd cry out. They had a hard time, too. Oh, my God. So much. That's why I was, like you said, you've heard it from someone else. They didn't talk about it. No, nobody talked about it.
What allowed you to start talking about it? And I know you've talked about it to school groups. You've made presentations.
When people wanted to know more information, you start opening up a little bit at a time. Mm-hmm. And that's where I'm at today. It's been over 70 years, and I have talked about it. People wanted to know. For instance, when I went back to one of the cemeteries, the guide there was a Belgian man. He was in the Belgian Air Force during the Second World War. He trained in Arizona, so he knew the English language quite well. He says, I want to show you something. We went to the office. He went into his private office for some paperwork or stuff. And there happened to be a book on that little table. And as I opened that book, opened this page, there's a picture of me. This was a staged burial. Myself was in there, and another fellow named Kistner, another Herberts. Kistner was from California. The other guy was from Illinois. They snapped that picture. And as he came out of the office, he started crying. I says, what's wrong? He says, the only reason that picture's in that book, because all the moms and dads that would come over here, they wanted to know if they were buried in just mud or something like that, or dirt or something like that. Well, I want to let you know that they were buried at that time in mattress covers. They were tied. It was a symbol that we had to do. We didn't want to do what that general said. We don't want no mass graves here. Mm-hmm. They weren't. So rest your mind, folks. They weren't. They were well taken care of. I know this day they're packed in ice and brought back. It's a different story now. But that at that time, there was no refrigeration for us.
So the best that you could do is get them in a mattress cover and get them in the ground. Did that mean something to you to hear him say that photo, just that photo, provided comfort for families?
Absolutely.
That probably changed your perspective on what you did or why you did it.
That's right. I know I'm proud of what I did in the war. I know I talk a lot about the war stuff. A lot of people couldn't take it, but somebody had to do it. Everybody didn't fight with a rifle. There was mailmen, and there was cooks, and there was truck drivers, and I had a carbine over my shoulder all the time, but I never fired it one time overseas.
But just my guess, and I've talked to guys who are in every combat situation you can imagine, I doubt very many of them would want to trade their spot with yours.
That's what I've heard from time and time again.
An unenviable job. I've got to ask you, you described June 7th, and temporarily burying 458 on the beach. At the time, you have no idea what June 6th is going to be,
that
we're going to be talking about it 70 years later.
Absolutely not.
But now with the benefit of history and knowing how pivotal that day was in the world, how should those 458 guys be remembered? What's the significance of their sacrifice?
Those people were the first ones to die in France. I still remember them and how they were taken care of. But I have really no solid way of describing my feelings, or do I want to?
And that was just the beginning for you. That's the day that gets the headlines.
And 80,000 later, the last guy that died. Yeah, my company of 125, total is about 80,000.
That's how many your company buried.
Yeah, and there was maybe 8 or 10 companies in Europe doing the same work. You know, I think I've said too much.
No.
No?
Never. But I am curious, knowing how painfully aware you are of the death that's happening, where you are, and on the other side of the globe with your brother passing away. Were there ever times when you'd have one of these close calls where you thought, boy, somebody must be looking out for me?
Absolutely. You know what came on my mind? I would say to myself, I'm too young to die. I just keep repeating, I'm too young to die. I haven't seen nothing yet. Those are the words that came to my mind all the time. I'm too young to die.
All of D-Day's Gold Star heroes were too young to die, but their sacrifice helped save America and save the world. Keep your eyes and ears peeled this week for 80th anniversary tributes in Normandy and around the globe, and I hope you can join us again for another D-Day-themed episode of Hometown Heroes next time, when we'll once again be reminded through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.